By and by, I reproached him for his conduct, to try if that could win a response, but he only smiled, and wearily laying his book aside, turned to someone whom I could not see and said, "Will you tell your mamma that I wish to speak to her?" Apostrophe. What did he mean? What was any other woman to him when I was present? Was it possible that he had gone back to Sadie after all, and wished her to be at hand to witness my humiliation? All my old jealousy was aroused at the thought, and a sudden frenzy carried me past all restraint, in anticipation of the coming scene. I felt a stranger enter, but was neither able to see nor hear who it was, a fact adding considerably to the mystery and terror which possessed me. Was I equally invisible and inaudible to her? It would seem so, for while I heard every word which Charlie uttered, and saw every movement he made, and could understand that the conversation had not the slightest reference to myself, I was still ignored as completely as if I had had no existence. Was it possible they were playing an arranged part to drive me to distraction? Who was this woman? Oh, God! That I had been equally deaf and blind to Charlie's conduct as she was to me. It was not Sadie, but I heard him call her by a name he never could have given to me. Then I knew his baseness and treachery, found a full explanation of the conduct I had received. He was simply mocking me. Whether she was cognizant of my nearness or not, he was aware of it, had secured my presence that I might witness his happiness with a rival who had supplanted me, as I had taken him from Sadie, that he might laugh as he saw how the knowledge of it would torture me. This was too much. The certainty of his desertion maddened me, but to witness his love passages with my rival goaded me into a diabolical frenzy, and I determined to kill him before her eyes. Alas! Ere I had time to move, the light which surrounded him expired, and I was left again in that Egyptian blackness, afraid to stir on account of the terror which came back with my blindness. Still could hear him, worse, I could hear her, heard without the power to stop my ears, or prevent my knowledge of what she said and called him. Rage and jealousy tormented and mocked my helplessness, until I prepared to follow the sound and wreak my revenge by laying them dead side by side. Horror! When I would have slain them, I found that I was as powerless to move as I was to see, and I was compelled to stand and listen to his perfidy, unable to make a sound to drown the echoes of his caresses. A thousand times over would I have chosen the gradual petrifaction of my previous state. The tortures of hell were increasing. Was it possible that it could hold anything in store more excruciating than my present punishment? I prayed to go mad, that in my madness I might find relief from such poignant pain, but my prayer came back like a stream of molten lead falling upon my head and burning fiery channels into my brain, increasing my agony yet a hundredfold, and bringing to me a consciousness that my actual retribution was but just commencing, that it would continue to increase, and I should be compelled to bear it, since no escape was possible. I was chained to him, and for periods of time, as long as eternity it seemed to be, I was made to endure this indescribable development of excruciating chastisement, with every nerve quickened to a sense of feeling defying description, while memory itself is not strong enough to grasp its intensity. Madness could not come to my relief, death could not listen to my pleadings, insensibility was palsied and could not approach me, pity was beyond the reach of my wailing, and mercy had not power to enter the domain in which I was a prisoner. What could I do? Nothing but suffer. Why was it that no one would wake me from such a horrible nightmare? I cried, but there was none to answer me. I was in all the agonies of hell without even the poor consolation that I was suffering in company. I could not bear it, yet I could not escape. Was there no possible limit to human endurance, no high water mark of vengeance, which, having touched, I should know that my sin had been atoned for? I must have help from somewhere, anywhere, so long as it broke the infernal monotony of my ever-increasing pain. Such a quick and lively sense had I of the exquisite tortures which were accumulating around me that I would gladly have served with slavish obedience any power which would manifest itself to change my condition if only to vary the punishment. If cessation was impossible, I would be content to take the rest of change, and for this I made a last appeal, even though my prayer returned, as in the case of that which initiated my state of fury, and I cried, "Oh, God or devil! Any being of pity or remorseless cruelty, hear me, and end my torments. Take me, tear me, or destroy me, drown my reason past all hope of restitution, or, by one tornadic blast of torture, put an end to feeling and terminate this agony. Hell! Hell, in mercy, take pity on my condition, open your gates and let me bathe my sufferings in your fiery lake. Hell! Hell, I say, in mercy open and let me in." As she proceeded with her story, I perceived that the present faded from her mind, and she was back again, for the time, feeling and enduring a recollection of the horrible past. Gradually she changed into the woman she once had been until great beads of perspiration stood upon her face, her eyes dilated with a maniacal gleam, and she writhed in the sufferings which had been such a terrible reality. When her strength gave way with the intensity of her last effort, she fell exhausted at my feet. I, too, had been so carried away by her dramatic recital as to be oblivious for the moment, as to where we were, and as she fell looked nervously around, almost expecting to see those mythical gates opening before me in answer to her entreaty. It was with a long sigh of relief that I recognized Kushner and Azina hastening towards us. "Hush," he said, calmly, as through the sight afforded him intense gratification, "let her sleep, she will soon be better." "Kushner," I cried, "can this be true?" "Yes, poor child, it is true, and much more that is beyond her power to tell you. She had been reaping that harvest of her jealousy for more than 20 years when I first saw her. And you saved her. I can well understand why it is her chief pleasure to watch for your coming." But he was too busily engaged with Marie to offer any reply. Chapter 10 An Explanation. I have a vivid recollection of the fearful enjoyment and nervous bravery with which, as a child, I hunted for curios washed up by the incoming tide, paddling with my naked feet in the fluctuating waters on the sea beach. I have no doubt but that I accomplished the whole gamut of childish heroics in my adventures, and I am sure there were interludes of surprisingly rapid recessions as my watchful eye caught sight of some advancing wave calculated to reach out its arms a few inches beyond its predecessor. Hope and fear, success and failure, pleasure and disappointment irregularly alternated in my experience until, drenched with spray and cold, my guardian carried me away from the scene of my exploits, with scarcely sufficient treasure in my possession to convict me of petty larceny. It was an analogous experience through which I passed at this stage of my new life. I was again beside the sea, the infinite sea of spirit life. Wave after wave of revelation was rolling in, breaking upon the rocks of my ignorance, and drenching me with a blinding spray of knowledge. The mighty force, the rapid succession, the bewildering unfoldment, left me no time to appropriate the treasures which were continuously, and but for the moment, laid open to my view. Strange and unexpected objects were almost ceaselessly brought before me. Revelations of sight, touch, and hearing came upon me like a flood, and I could only stand confused, confounded and perplexed before the mighty force which surrounded, enveloped, me. I had been told it was love, all love, and that I should be presently able to understand and appreciate it. But now, I was like a lad thrown into the water, unable to swim. The force of the waves and the tide were against me. I tried to profit by the instruction I had received, but in my inexperience and lack of the power of immediate appropriation, I found it more natural to flounder and aimlessly battle with the storm which threatened to engulf me, alternately hoping and almost doubting the result. Such was candidly my attitude for a brief period at the time of which I am speaking. Without opportunity for reflection, events of such an unexpected, and previously considered impossible character, were being so rapidly unfolded before me, that with a nature prone to doubt and full of dismal forebodings such as mine was, it was too much for me to reach so near the perfect ideal as to view the developments of my instruction with feelings of equanimity and calm confidence. There is a general idea among mankind that by the simple process of dying we are translated into a condition of omniscience, and solve every problem in the twinkling of an eye. It was with a sense of deepest gratitude that I discovered the fallacy of such teachings, and the wider my experience ranges the more astounded I am that this preposterous assumption could ever have originated, or found a sanction in the minds of intelligent human beings. Every single question I asked, every scene I beheld, every sound I heard, had its own special revelation to make, and the rapidity with which each successive wave of information rolled over me, allowed me no time for recovery from the grandeur of its power and scope, before which I reeled in wonder and amazement, and the same is equally true of the present as it is of the past. What, then, would have become of me if the full flood of the knowledge I have acquired, and, let me assure you, I have but yet been able to touch the merest fringe of that still to be attained, had broken over me like a thunder bolt at the moment when I opened my bewildered eyes upon the slope where I so unsuccessfully tried to answer the simple query, where am I? Be not deceived. God ever tempers the wind to the shorn lamb. He knows our frame, and hath ordained that our soul, expansion shall proceed under conditions best suited to our state, and which also tend to magnify His majesty and love. Knowledge can only be acquired as we have power to assimilate each successive phase of truth. It has no force, no life, no energy, unless applied, and the man who tries to accumulate it without the correspondingly necessary strength to utilize the same, if successful, would only find he had gathered together and built an edifice which, for lack of support, would fall and crush him in its ruin. This strength to wield the weight of knowledge can only come by steady growth, and therefore if it were practicable to test the instantaneous, explosive principle, in the twinkling of an eye, in its expansion, it could never give the finite strength enough to grasp the infinite. This must be attained by the gradual transformation of our lives into the Christ life, which in its turn must be converted into the infinite as we further expand into the likeness and character of God. When we stand in close proximity to an overwhelming surprise, I have no doubt it is the perturbation caused and from which we have not had time to recover, that leads us to suppose this last event to be the most momentous in our career. Some such idea as this took possession of myself as I gazed upon the inanimate form lying at my feet, and which neither Kushner nor Azina appeared anxious to disturb for a time. I tried, but vainly, to reconcile the painful episode I had witnessed with the one law of love which I had been assured held universal sway in this life. The problem was too deep, too complex, for me to undertake, and at length I was reluctantly compelled to put it aside until I could gain some wider experience than my own to elucidate the mystery. While I was thus disturbed and perplexed, my two companions were calmly watching the unconscious Marie. Evidently there would be something for them to do, but the period for action had not yet arrived. Now was the time for waiting, and this they did in patience, calmly waited and watched, being perfectly ready for ministry when required. When that moment came, with very tender care and sympathy, they performed the service so well understood, and before the tear-dimmed eyes were again opened we had resumed our journey, leaving the spiritual convalescent to the sole charge of that friend on whom she had learned to repose. I had intended on my return to ask Kushner to give me time to study the action of those mysterious dews in changing the color of our dresses, to have sought for some explanation of his power in finding his way so unerringly through a trackless country, and a score of other matters which had suggested themselves to my mind, but all were forgotten, and now I had but one desire, which at the earliest moment I laid before him. "Kushner, tell me," I cried, "how can you reconcile your one law of love with the terrible scene I have just witnessed?" "I can well understand your difficulty," he replied, "and will try to explain it to you. Never forget that all life is a growth, a gradual transition from what we are, to what we shall be, by assimilating the influence of every experience through which we pass. Sudden changes are so in appearance only. Closer inspection will show they are all effects of causes which have been working, silently and unperceived it may be, and preparing developments which escape notice until forced upon our attention by some outward unfolding. All expansion works from the inner to the outer life, but we are naturally unable to admit the reality of anything which lies beyond the scope of observation. In nature we are not always accustomed to find sharp dividing lines. The darkest night rises by an imperceptible gradient into the glory of a cloudless morning, while it is very difficult for an inexperienced eye to decide at what moment the tide ceases to ebb and begins to flow. You cannot see the movement by which a flower unfolds its petals, yet the action is going on while your eyes are diligently watching. So it is with the spiritual life. It unfolds, never leaps, it flows like a stream, never bounds like an antelope. Its progress is a steady silent advance, only evidence to us as stages are reached. Such has been the career of Marie. It is impossible for me to relate, or make you understand how, or by what means, she has been gradually weaned from the terrible agony in which I first found her, a remnant of which you have just witnessed. You will become acquainted with it in a more practical form when you find employment in a similar mission. Let me for the present be satisfied by indicating to you how there is nothing inconsistent with the law of love in asking her to tell her story. The retention of individuality demands that the memory of the past shall never be effaced. The scar of every wrong we have done will forever remain, till, when we have paid its penalty, it ceases to be a source of pain. The wound slowly heals, the discomfort dies away, but the scar endures. Marie has now reached this healing stage, and every time she tells her story it is like another dressing of her wound, painful for the present, but beneficial in the result. Every recital is less agonizing than the last, and the exhaustion it causes induces a sleep from which she derives additional strength, which is very necessary to her progress. Without this she would be content to remain as she is, in the lull of rest after the poignant anguish, without sufficient energy to prompt her to further progress. Therefore what you have seen is but a wise provision to obliterate the past, so far as the pain is concerned, and push her onto a happier condition than she at present enjoys. But could not that be attained by her talking of the past to Azina? No. Not so effectively. Besides, such a course would be a waste of energy, which you will never find here. Everything is made to serve some useful purpose, and so you have learned what will be a valuable lesson by the present repetition. It has been helpful to others in the past, and still will be when her story is told again. In this way she becomes a powerful minister for good, while others are working for her salvation. Again, so far she has been limited to her one companion and must not be allowed to confine herself exclusively to Azina, or she will never feel the need of other friendships. Every visitor she has tends to excite new interests, so that when Azina leaves her, as she will when the telling of her story does not occasion an after sleep by its exhaustion, she will be so oppressed by her loneliness as to be forced from her retirement and find congenial society among those who are in a somewhat happier condition than her present home. And how long will it be before all this can be accomplished? That varies very considerably. Generally about the same length of time as the previous imprisonment. Have you any idea how long that was?
Yes.
As I have told you, it lasted about 20 years. 20 years. Oh! What a hell! What an experience! How I wish she could preach such a sermon in the ears of earth. My soul is full of longing to go back again and burn these revelations into my fellows. Oh! It is terrible to me to think how blind they are to these awful realities. I want them to know, to realize, that nothing but lives, noble self-sacrificing lives, and deeds can enter here to help in the determination of their future. I want to tell them that every wrong must be atoned for, and that by him who commits it, that there is no help, no escape, but every soul must work out its own salvation and thus be instrumental in bringing about a reformation whose result will be the doing of the will of God on earth, as it is done in heaven. My companion made no attempt to interrupt me, but as he walked beside me I could see a half amused, half regretful smile play across his face, and when I had finished he replied in his gravely quiet tone, "There are thousands, millions of friends here who have been animated and swayed by the feelings which now move you. But when the opportunity has come and they have proceeded to carry out their noble desires, they have found that which will yet be your own experience. In the first place, you will not be believed as to your identity, and will be called upon to fight a long and by no means complimentary battle to prove you are a messenger from this life. Next, having gained this point in the presence of a few, they will begin to demand from you numberless signs and wonders to strengthen this proof and gratify their curiosity. When you have succeeded in this, and your heart is burning to begin your work, someone else will be brought in, and they will demand that you shall go through the unwelcome process again, for the gratification of the late newcomer. In fact, this is the normal condition in which they desire to circumscribe our work, and the greatest care is needed not to drive them away before we have attempted to sow some grain of truth. When you reach this effort, you will find that they will claim to know even more about this life than you yourself, and you must be prepared for contradiction and correction in everything you say, while many of them will generously and frequently tell you that the error you are trying to teach savors very much of the realms of darkness because it is opposed to their teachings and beliefs. Let me advise you not to grow too enthusiastic over your anticipated mission to Earth. The great majority of mankind at present prefer to postpone any definite knowledge of this life until they arrive here. But I wish now to draw your attention to other experiences. Chapter 11. The Home of the Assyrian. My friend's remarks threw a shade of depression over my newly born enthusiasm, and started a review of probabilities in my mind which rendered me indifferent, for the moment, to his attempt to change their theme. But his second endeavor roused me to a consciousness of the panorama which lay before me, and succeeded, for the present at least, in putting an end to any feeling of gloom. I have said that my first impression of Marie's home was that it offered every facility, by its ever varying employments, for weaning a heart from sorrow, but the idea was only an abstract one, as neither those surroundings nor yet the more beautiful grounds in which I had met Kushner, at the home of rest, had, consciously, brought before my mind the question of manual labor in this new life. But the time for this had now come, and a fresh surprise carried my mind and inquiries away in another direction. We were standing upon the crest of a mountain, one of a chain curving itself around a valley sufficiently picturesque to inspire a poet or artist with a dream of Eden. From between the hills, at the farther end, a silver stream fell in a series of lofty cascades into the plain, which thus divided into almost equal portions, was enhanced in beauty by the crystal presence of the majestic river. One feature here presented particularly attracted my attention, and led me to inquire whether art had not been called to the assistance of nature to produce the pleasing result. Near the center of the valley, the course of the river was suddenly diverted to the right and left for the purpose of forming an island, perhaps about a mile in extent, which made a splendid platform or foundation for the extensive palace or mansion which was the principal object of attraction. "You are quite right," said Kushner, "in answer to my inquiries the stream has been at some time turned aside for the purpose of forming the island. But you don't mean to tell me there is such a thing as manual labor in heaven? Is it not a perfect place as far as such things are concerned?" "To answer your last question first," he said, "heaven is not, at present, a perfect place. I know such is the earth idea, but it is unscriptural, and has not a shadow of justification in the teaching of Jesus, who told his disciples, I go to prepare a place for you, which very truth implies imperfection, because unprepared. On the other hand, this life is one in which every power finds full employ. The poet is capable of receiving higher inspirations, but of what avail if he may not write them? Did the talents of Raphael, Francis Angelico or Turner only unfold for the momentary span of Earth's uncongenial day? Do you think that the dreams of beauty and grace which are here begat of the genius of Phidias or Michelangelo are to be condemned to lie imprisoned in the sanctuary of their own conception? Where are the mighty architects who built Thebes and Babylon, Jerusalem, Athens and Rome? Have such minds no inspirations when they behold the sights, the capabilities and the resources of immortality? Are Handel, Mozart and Beethoven tired of harmony, or have they drained the fount of music dry? One recoils from the thought of what heaven would be without the active employment of such great minds as these. Let me ask you also, has not the gardener some ideal to consummate, and shall he be deterred from giving scope to his genius where it may be displayed free from the unpropitious influences against which we had to contend with on earth? Music and painting, sculpture and architecture, have had their plodders and toilers, who have lived, while this book does not explain in any depth the notion of ever-perfect higher spheres. This idea is described in a number of newer revelations such as the Paget Messages and in the Urantia book. It can also be understood from reading the entire series of books by R. J. Lees, and died unsuccessful and unappreciated, quite as much as the laborers of the pick and shovel. They loved their art, and heaven's compensation is to be found in the realization of their hopes. Yes, my friend, there is room for work here. But what makes all the difference? There is no toil or labor. Our only incentive to work is love, not to earn an existence, but to produce an outward semblance of that which is born within and which prompts and forms the mainspring of our activity. I was silent, but my mind grew heavy with the thoughts it carried. The one object that attracted my attention more than any other was the palace or mansion occupying the island, and which I was informed was the home of the Assyrian, an announcement causing me some amusement at first, as the idea of its being a residence of any kind would have been the last to enter my mind. My first and instinctive conception of it was a vast floral pyramid built and arranged as a central and finishing effect in a charming valley. The base of the building was, perhaps, more than a quarter of a mile in extent, but the gradual elevation of the ground from the water's edge gave it the appearance, from the point at which I first beheld it, of its being of considerably greater proportions than it was in reality. It was not until we had crossed one of the picturesque bridges which formed the approach, that I could entirely divest my mind of my original idea, for the presence of the number of people who were visible was quite as consistent with the one explanation as the other. But when ascending from the river my eye began to penetrate the foliage. I could then discern the architectural arrangement by which the pleasing and novel effect was produced. Each story, of which there were 10, was so constructed as to leave a terrace some 30 feet in width around the whole building, the outer edges being planted with beds of flowers, then shrubs, and finally palms and other trees, whose branches made a stately promenade. My undivided attention, however, could not be given to the building, for Kushner had already communicated our approach to Siamese, who came to meet and welcome us as we crossed the bridge. We were also objects of curiosity to numbers of others, who, I was informed, were anxious to learn who the newcomer might be, and whether it might be possible I was the bearer of news from friends still on earth. I found that this was one of a number of homes where the souls of those who are wearied in well-doing, and have fought and come off more than conquerors might rest a while, and be ministered to, in order that they might enter upon the joys of heaven with all their energies revived and strengthened, so as to be able to fully appreciate those glories which further awaited them. Here they grew strong, while the vibrations of the conflict pass away, experience the peace of the eternal hush after the storm, enjoy the relief of throwing off the armor, and enter upon the liberty of repose, never again to be broken. I was told that the condition of individuals varies considerably at such times, but that, generally, they are limited in their knowledge of what transpires on earth, and for this reason, watch new arrivals for information. Siamese was not attired as I saw him at the corral, but had assumed a loosely flowing robe of electric grey, over which alternate blushes of pink and blue seemed to beat like pulse throbs, but he was not the less regal in appearance. The first time I met him he was arrayed in robes of state, now, he was the monarch at home. But oh! What a conception of royalty I formed, as I watched this subsidiary ruler of the King of Kings. The diadem he wore was one of service, while the scepter he swayed radiated an influence, in the presence of which revolt and treachery would have been annihilated. The gems with which it was set excited no greed or avarice, while it was wielded not with a mandate of destruction, but a command to live. The hand of the tyrant or oppressor could not grasp it, neither could the stain of blood ever touch it, for that emblem of rule divine has come from the hands of God, who had himself engraved upon it the name of Love. As I looked upon him I was involuntarily drawn towards him, when he threw his arms tenderly around me, and we walked forward, I, at least, being perfectly happy and contented. How could I be otherwise? I was beginning to grow accustomed to the great advantages I had inherited in this new life, which was void of any time limit, and as page after page was turned over, I could see how occupations were provided to engage my soul through the long eternities which lay before me. The old visionary and inane heaven had passed away, and in its place had been discovered a rest which would be an employment, a worship which was an unfoldment. An apotheosis is only to be reached by the expansion of the divinity, which although unknown had always lain buried within myself. We sauntered along. Why not? I stood on the shores of the eternal sea, and every step had its myriad of grains, each with its special revelation to make. Every person we met had a different life story to tell, and I had nothing to do but learn.